WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear the story of a forgotten crisis in the early days of the modern global jihadi movement. On November 20th, 1979, which was the first day of the new century on the Islamic calendar, Islamic extremists took over the Grand Mosque of Mecca in the hopes of starting a global war that would lead to Islam's total victory. My guest, journalist Yaroslav Trofimov, has written a new book about the crisis called The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda. He says the story isn't well known for a couple of reasons. The House of Saud did its best to prevent news of the siege from getting out. And the Carter administration didn't realize the significance of the siege, in part because it was so focused on the Iranian hostage crisis. Trofimov has been a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal since 1999 and has reported extensively from Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. Yaroslav Trofimov, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we really get into the story, where do you see the story fitting in the rise of radical Islam?
I think this was really the beginning of the modern jihadi radical violent movement that led to Al-Qaeda. If you look at the history of this radical movement, the very first operation that was transnational, that involved terrorists from several countries, Saudi Arabia, the United States, Egypt, what's really this one, the 1979 takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca? This is really where it all began.
Well, let's get to the story. Why did this group of radical Islamists take over the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979? What were their grievances?
Well, they really believe that the, first of all, Saudi Arabia has strayed from the path of true Islam. They objected to things like the presence of Western embassies, the presence of Westerners as such in the kingdom, the alliance with the United States, and even trivial things like the fact that pictures were being used on currency, the portraits were hanging on the walls of offices, even though in their view of Islam, Islamic scriptures prohibit any graven images. So going from that, they hoped and they believed that by taking over the Grand Mosque, they would start the worldwide movement to purify Islam and to eventually triumph in the entire world. The ideology was quite messianic. They believed that one of them was going to be the Mahdi, the new redeemer. And the day was not accidental. This was the very first dawn of the 14th century of the Islamic calendar, which, according to some prophecies, is the time when the redeemer would come.
So did the people who took over the Grand Mosque in Mecca believe that the end of the world was imminent?
Some of them did. The Saudis definitely believed that. Many of the Egyptians and other foreign radicals who joined them were more opportunistic. They didn't necessarily share the messianic beliefs, but they thought that this would be the spark that would start the worldwide uprising because of the huge symbolism of the place. This is the holiest place in Islam. Every Muslim, every day, five times a day, must pray facing towards the Grand Mosque. Even in death, Muslims are buried with their faces towards the Grand Mosque. And that very morning, there were more than 100,000 pilgrims from the world over in that mosque.
Tell us about the leader of the siege, Juhayman al-Utaybi. Who was he?
Well, Juhayman al-Utaybi's history is very interesting. His father was very active in the uprising by the radical Islamist Bedouin tribes against the House of Saud in the 1920s. That was an uprising against the government's decision to open up to the West, to establish relations with Western countries, and to bring in some such devilish innovations as cars and radio and telegraphs. So he had this history of family resentment against the monarchy. He joined the Saudi National Guard. He was a corporal there. But then he started studying the Islamic religion in the university in Medina, which was one of the new universities established by King Faisal in the 1960s and 70s, where many of the teachers and the professors were Islamic radicals from Egypt and Syria and other places who brought the ideology that had been developed by the Muslim Brotherhood and by their outfits to Saudi Arabia. So this blend of the traditional Bedouin zeal and the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood was what really fueled him. And he became, he was a very charismatic figure. And so instantly he gained following from many, many younger students who saw him as sort of a guru.
So he was radicalized at the university?
He was opposed to the regime since his childhood. But he really got into the Islamic theology and became involved with the Islamic movement at the university in Medina. And the head of the university at the time was Sheikh bin Baz, who would in the future become the supreme religious authority of Saudi Arabia, the Grand Mufti, and who was very sympathetic initially to this movement.
Now, the people who took over the mosque smuggled their guns in coffins. Coffins? Wouldn't coffins look suspicious in the mosque?
Well, coffins are not suspicious at all because by Muslim tradition, if you want to bestow the blessings on your departed relatives and to ensure that they are well off in paradise, you have to bring the body to the Grand Mosque and have the Imam bless it. Oh. So always, especially at the end of the Hajj season, you could see at the time hundreds of people bringing their relatives, sometimes all the way from India or from Iraq, to the holiest shrine that a Muslim can ever visit.
Since this is the holiest shrine in Islam, isn't it disrespectful to bring in guns and use them?
Well, certainly it's disrespectful and very unusual. It's really the very first time that guns were used inside the mosque. And in the Muslim tradition, you cannot even hurt a bird in that sacred precinct, let alone discharge a gun. So this was why there was really no defense organized against such an intrusion. The guards in the mosque were only armed with sticks to beat up some misbehaving pilgrims. They didn't have any guns or ammunition themselves.
So paint a picture for us of how the siege started, how they got in, and what they did once they got into the Holy Mosque.
Well, once they smuggled in the weapons, and they didn't just smuggle them in the coffins, but they also had bribed some guards of the Bin Laden company that was doing construction work in the mosque and had driven three truckloads of ammunition into the basement. So once they've done that, Juhayman al-Rutaybi and his gunmen marched to the very center of the enclosure during the dawn prayers. He pushed away the imam of the mosque, who had been his teacher before, and announced that the mosque has been taken over. His gunmen fired in the air. The plan was very well organized. So they raced towards the almost 50 gates of this enormous sort of stadium-sized enclosure and locked these 100,000 pilgrims inside. Then they went up the minarets. There were 7 minarets in the Grand Mosque at the time, and they were the tallest structure in the city of Mecca. And they established sniper nests at the very top of these minarets. And from there, they could keep the entire city in the field of fire and very effectively repel future attacks by the Saudi forces.
What about the thousands and thousands of people who'd come to pray at the Holy Mosque? What happened to them?
Initially, Juhayman al-Rutaybi and his followers read out their manifesto, explained what they wanted to do. And the Grand Mosque at the time, and still today, had the very powerful radio system that would broadcast the 5 daily prayers throughout the entire city. So the entire city could hear what they wanted to do. So once they've done that, he presented his brother-in-law, whom he believed was the Messiah, and made everybody in the mosque pledge allegiance to him. Once that happened, the Saudis, especially the Saudis among the pilgrims, those who looked more religious, who had long bushy beards, were told to stay and help defend the mosque against the infidel onslaught of the regime. The foreigners were allowed to escape through a few windows in the basement. And slowly, slowly, over the next few days, they trickled out because obviously Juhayman didn't have water or food to keep such a large number of hostages inside.
My guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov. His new book is called The Siege of Mecca. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov. He's a foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He covers Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. His new book is called The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda. after the siege, you know, the king wanted to end the siege as quickly as possible, which was going to prove very difficult to do. One of the things the king did was meet with the highest clergy, the ulema, and try to work out a fatwa with them. Why did he need a fatwa from them, and what kind of compromise did he have to work out?
Well, he needed a fatwa from the senior clergy because many soldiers refused to fight, again, because of this Islamic prohibition on using weapons in the shrine. They would just wouldn't point their guns towards the Grand Mosque in the very first days of this tragedy. And also, many of them believed what they had heard. They believed that the Messiah had come. This was, as foretold in the prophecy, the very first day of the new century. And so they really needed convincing by the religious authorities that following the orders was something legitimate, that they would not go to hell, literally, if they executed the commands of the military. So once the king realized that he had such a problem, he summoned the top leaders of the clergy to his palace in Riyadh. And they had a very long discussion there, because first of all, the clerics had to look at the facts and figure out whether indeed the Messiah had arrived. Many of them knew Juhayman al-Rutaybi and they knew his followers, if only because just a year earlier, many of them had been arrested on sedition charges. And the top clerics had personally intervened with the Saudi government asking for their release. So they knew who they were dealing with. And a big compromise was struck at the time. The top clerics said, yes, we will let you go and recapture the mosque, but in exchange, you must stop this slide towards secularism and modernization that was occurring in Saudi Arabia at the time. Back then, women could be seen narrating the news on television. And in some places, they were even driving. So that grand bargain was struck. And in exchange for the religious endorsement of the storming of the Grand Mosque, the Saudi government did roll back many of the religious freedoms in the following years. And also, they channeled billions and billions of dollars in their oil revenues towards the clerical establishment so they could spread their ideology all over the Muslim world. And the direct result of this is the emergence of Al-Qaeda later, because many of Al-Qaeda's recruits in places like Pakistan, like the Balkans, like Indonesia, or like Bangladesh, did go to the Saudi-funded academies that sprang up as a direct result of the siege of Mecca.
How did the rules of engagement change once the Saudi king got the fatwa from the top clerics of Saudi Arabia?
The Saudi government is pretty much reckless as far as human casualties go. You know, when the commanders were complaining about almost suicidal missions in which they were being sent, Prince Nayef, the interior minister, would say, you know, they will become martyrs and go to paradise and everybody will envy them, so let them die. So the biggest care that they took in the first days was not to damage the actual shrine, because the government knew that if the shrine is damaged, securing clerical approval for the operation will be much more difficult. But once they had this fatwa in hand, once it was broadcast, then they started using heavy force. They used artillery, they used armored personnel carriers, they used aviation, and a large part of the structure was destroyed.
Large part of the mosque?
Well, the mosque itself is very big. In the center of it stands the Kaaba, which is really the holy site, the building that supposedly was built by the biblical Ibrahim many millennia ago. But after that, around it, there is a courtyard. And encircling the courtyard is the actual mosque. So that mosque was built fairly recently, and most of the structures there were erected in the 20th century and built by the Bin Laden family.
Yeah, talk about paradoxes there. Like the Bin Laden family builds the mosque. Part of the mosque is destroyed during the siege, and the siege kind of, the way you describe it, leads in part to the start of Al-Qaeda and to the radicalization of young Bin Laden, of Osama Bin Laden.
Well, Osama Bin Laden was very impressed and very deeply troubled by what he saw happening in Mecca. You know, he was living at the time in Jeddah, just 1 hour's driving away. And his brother, who at the time ran the company, was involved in the effort. He was cloistered with the senior princes, helping them storm the mosque, because he was the only one who had the blueprints of the basement and of the structure, because his company had built much of it. And Osama bin Laden, in the following years, repeatedly said that this was the moment of truth for him. And he empathized more with Juhayman and the rebels than with the Saudi government, whom he accused of desecrating the mosque by sending threaded vehicles and using artillery in such a holy site.
But it's just so confusing to me why he would identify with the radicals who brought guns into the holy site in the first place. I mean, that seems like a desecration.
Well, he viewed them as idealists who only brought guns to defend themselves. And when Juhayman was explaining the operation to his co-conspirators, that was what he was saying. We only need guns if we are attacked. We are in the right. God is with us. And many Islamists who were upset by what had happened there would have preferred for the government just to wait it out and wait until the water and the food had finished in the mosque instead of storming it so violently.
What kind of help did the Saudis ask the United States for during the siege of Mecca?
Well, the Americans were involved on many levels in the tragedy in Mecca. First of all, a few of the co-conspirators of the members of Juhayman's terrorist group were African-American converts to Islam who had been brainwashed while studying in Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, the Saudi Arabian government did not have enough pilots of its own, so it had to use Americans who were working in the kingdom to fly a combat mission in helicopters above the mosque. More formally, the government had asked for some advice from the CIA, which had a long-standing program to train and equip Saudi internal security forces. But one must remember, this was a time when the CIA's reputation was at a pretty low level in the world. It was just a few years after the congressional hearings. And so Prince Turki, who was at the time the head of the Saudi intelligence, didn't put much stock in what the CIA could do for him. So instead, he ended up turning to the French intelligence. And interestingly, at that time, the French, unlike now, were the interventionist hardcore power that believed in using military force to oust unfriendly regimes, whereas the Carter administration was seen as sort of in retreat and abhorring any use of force anywhere in the world. Sort of an interesting reversal of the roles today.
So it was French commandos who helped the Saudis end the siege of Mecca.
The French role was very important. The French government had dispatched its elite team called GIGN, which was probably at the time the best commando force in Europe, if not in the world. They had trained Delta forces later on. And this small unit had brought with them a large amount of poison gas and training materials. And they set up shop not far from Mecca in the city of Taif. And they trained and planned the operation to flush out the rebels from the basement of the mosque once the surface had been recaptured. Because the basement really was the most difficult part. It's a network of about 1,000 rooms, all different levels with narrow corridors where tanks or threat vehicles could not be used. And so they devised a plan to perforate the ceiling of the basement and to fire down large amounts of poison gas that killed or knocked out most of the rebels and allowed the stormtroops to jump down and to reoccupy the basement.
And then after the siege was ended, all the radicals who were captured ended up being beheaded.
All the adult rebels who were captured in the mosque in December 1979 were either beheaded in public in several Saudi cities in January 1980 or were killed in secret in custody in the following month. So the only survivors who know what actually went on during the siege from within are people who were 15, 16, 14 years at the time. They were giving long prison sentences, but they're still alive today. And part of the book is based on my interviews with them on their testimonies of what they had witnessed at the time.
Now, in your book, you make it seem like the siege of Mecca was really a turning point in radical Islam and the start of, you know, like the prequel to Al-Qaeda.
Exactly.
The Carter administration was in power in 1979 during the siege. And the siege happened at the start of the third week of the Iranian hostage crisis, which was capturing the attention of the Carter administration and of a lot of America at the time. Did the Carter administration see the siege of Mecca as being significant and as having large implications for the future of the United States?
If one reads American documents from that time, the documents from the State Department, from the CIA, or from within the White House, it almost looks like a comedy of errors, because initially, once the siege started, the working assumption in Washington was that the Iranians had done it. And once the news broke, and the news broke in Washington for the first time, this was the message given out by the administration. The Iranians had occupied the Grand Mosque. The Iranians want to overthrow al-Saud. And obviously, the Iranians are very unhappy to hear that. So the next day, they turn around and accuse the Americans and the Zionists. And this led to terrible violence in following days and the burning of the American embassy in Pakistan. But later on, once the siege ended, I looked at the CIA reporting. And their conclusion was, oh, this is a one-off event. This is just a throwback to the distant past. Radical Islam is not at all a danger in the future. So really, the administration blinked on this one and missed the significance of it. And one must remember also that this wasn't just happening as the Iranian hostage crisis was unfolding. This was happening a few weeks, 2-3 weeks before the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. And once that invasion happened, all of a sudden, all these radical Islamists were seen as a useful resource that could be thrown against the Soviets in Afghanistan, which is what happened in following years.
My guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov. His new book is called The Siege of Mecca. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov, a foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His new book, The Siege of Mecca, is about the crisis in 1979 when Islamic extremists took over the Grand Mosque of Mecca. Trofimov describes it as the start of the modern global jihadi movement. Your book is filled with a lot of historically interesting information, and part of that interesting history had to do with how the Saudis, the Saudis, like before this 1979 siege, had welcomed a lot of jihadis and Islamists to Saudi Arabia because they felt they had something in common. These Islamists opposed the secular governments of Egypt and other countries. Saudi Arabia had a religious government, so it was different. Egypt and other countries earlier in the century had advocated pan-Arabism, this kind of like, a one-state kind of thing based on Arab identity. The Saudis didn't want that. They wanted a religious state. And they felt this connection to the Islamic radicals, but that connection ended up backfiring on them.
Well, absolutely. They were blindsided by what had happened because traditionally, Saudi Arabia saw itself as the guardian of Islam, and its prestige and its security was laid on the fact that they could claim that we are the most Islamic country in the world, therefore we can lead the Muslim world. It doesn't matter that we are a relatively small country in terms of population, that our culture doesn't go as deep as the culture in Egypt or in Syria and other traditional centers of the Arab world. But by the virtue of being the most Islamic state in the world at the time, they felt pretty safe. And suddenly somebody from within challenges that and says, well, you're not Islamic enough for us. We want to go further. And you really are infidels. So that was a big shock to the House of Saud. And they tried to cope with this in following years by buying off that more radical movement and by channeling its energies outside of Saudi Arabia through this network of missionary activities and schools and charities.
So they bought off the radicals by funding their schools and other activities, which would you say that continued to backfire against the powers that be in Saudi Arabia?
Well, it certainly took the attention of the radical movement away from Saudi Arabia for a decade or two, but it did backfire in recent years because that is one of the factors that led to the creation of Al-Qaeda, which has been attacking within Saudi Arabia again in the last few years, bombing hotels and bombing housing complexes and military installations. So that is a threat that in a way was bred by the government itself.
So you've told the story of a not a very well-known chapter in the history of radical Islam. How would you like this story to change the way we see that history?
Well, first of all, this really shows the power of this radical ideology and how it's a fairly small group of people, but powered by the zeal and the beliefs, could stave off the entire Saudi army. And for 2 weeks in the most sensitive place in the world. And the other lesson is that just how badly it was misjudged by the West. The West blinked at the time. They didn't realize what was going on and didn't realize the consequences of what had happened for another 20 plus years.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Yaroslav Trofimov is the author of the new book, The Siege of Mecca. He's a foreign correspondent for the Wall.